Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. Your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra performs just two pieces this week, but they are mighty. Here to tell us about them is your RPO music director, Ward Steer. Welcome back, Ward.
Thank you, Julia. Nice to be here.
All right, so we have two pieces of music, and one of them is known and loved, and the other one is a complete cipher. So let's wander into the unknown with this piece by Leonard Slatkin.
Yes, it's a very compelling piece. I think it's really powerful and poignant, and it's got a very personal story behind it for Leonard. So kina is a word which means like elegy or requiem or in memoriam, you know, kind of, and it's dedicated to his parents, who were both very famous musicians in Hollywood and sort of from the 30s-ish to the 50s, late 50s, early 60s. And his mother and father were, his mother was a cellist, his father was a violinist. She was the principal cellist at major studio, Fox Studios, and he was the concertmaster of Warner Brothers. So at Warner's, you know, any movie that came out in that period, during that time, you would hear if there's a violin solo, it was Leonard Slatkin's father, Felix. And same with his mother on the cello, Eleanor Adler, I think was her last name. So they were sort of Hollywood royalty in a way, musical royalty. Everybody knew them around town, and they played together quite a bit. But one thing they never got a chance to do was the Brahms Double Concerto, which they both really loved. And so they had finally scheduled a performance of it in 1963. And it was highly anticipated. A lot of people were, you know, the town was abuzz about it, and it was going to be a well-attended affair. And they started rehearsals in the middle of the week, as, you know, you typically do. Tuesday, Wednesday, probably rehearsals, I'm not sure. And then the concert was set for Saturday. And Friday night, Felix, Leonard's father, had a fatal heart attack. And so they were never able to perform the Brahms Double together in public. And so Leonard has written this piece, which is very haunting and beautiful. I think it's a wonderful tribute to his parents. He's taken a theme from the Brahms Double, and he's got harmonies from the piece and also little strains and fragments of the melodies that are thrown into the mix in the orchestra, but the chords and the harmonies come in most often in the forms of clusters. There are a lot of effects, eerie effects in the percussion, and so the piece is very atmospheric and really evokes, you know, a memory, a painful memory in a lot of ways. And then at the very end of the piece, there is an offstage violin and cello part that are played together, which, again, quotes phrases from the Brahms Double, but the phrases are never completed, which is meant, Leonard says, to remind us that they never, in fact, got to play this in public. So it's a very touching tribute that Leonard Slatkin has made to his parents, and I think it works beautifully. And I like the piece also in connection with Mahler, because remember, in Mahler's time, he was known as a conductor, not a composer. And of course, you know, Leonard Slatkin has not written monumental symphonies like Mahler did, but, you know, Leonard Slatkin is, of course, one of the most famous American conductors of our time. And but he also writes some music, and so I thought it was a great thing to include on the program. It's only about 14 minutes long. So it'll open with that in a kind of reflective place, and I think put us in a good place to hear the Mahler.
So it will be a very early intermission.
It will indeed, yes, yes.
How do you handle that off, or unless you don't want to tell us, your offstage violinist, because normally that would be Juliana, who's sitting front and center, so does she just waltz off stage?
Well, Juliana's not actually playing it. Our principals are not playing it. We've selected two musicians from the section. Molly Wirtz and Ben Krug are going to play, or Wirtz McDonald, I forget. She's married to our principal bassoon player now. I forget how she has it in the program. But either way, Molly and Ben are going to be playing off stage, and they'll be off stage the entire time, so I think it would be distracting for the mood if you saw two people physically get up and leave the stage. So we'll have them preset backstage. And actually, the way, and there's also an offstage flugelhorn and trumpet, by the way, which is played. So there's sort of antiphonal. The trumpet flugelhorn is on one side of the backstage area. The violin and cello are on the other. You never see those musicians during the performance. It's just meant as a haunting sort of voice from beyond.
that voice from beyond is used on a fairly regular basis. Not fairly regular, but it's used, and it's always so effective. The Symphonie Fantastique, I'm thinking about that, and I'm thinking about the Titan, the Mahler Symphony.
Mahler's first symphony, yeah, yeah.
Where they have the horns offstage, right?
Right, well, trumpets in the beginning. Yeah, they play the fanfare. And
so, like the Titan, which was just performed by the University of Rochester Symphony for Dr. David Herman's last, his very last concert, I am reminded, because here we are, four symphonies down the line, same composer, and there he is again, once again, opening with the big fanfare and with the big brass. What was the statement for the fifth?
Well, the fifth is interesting for a lot of reasons. I think it, if you look at it in the line of, you know, symphonies that Mahler wrote, it begins a period where he got away from using the voice so much, as he of course did in the second and third symphony. He goes back to the purely orchestral writing, and his style starts to change quite a bit in the fifth, sixth, and seventh. And so I think that's important to keep in mind when you're interpreting it. And also, for Mahler, I think it's maybe his most autobiographical work, if you consider the complete journey from start to finish.
It also is a lot less folksy. And his first few symphonies, you can hear that folk song, maybe a cowbell here or there. Mm. This seems to go into something a little, for lack of a better word, something more cosmopolitan, maybe a little sleeker.
Well, there's both, though. There is folksy music in it. I mean, in the scherzo, there's the great Landler, which is, he contrasts with Viennese waltz, which is, again, you know, he grew up in a small city between Prague and Vienna, which was a military sort of outpost. And so he grew up with a lot of folk music. He grew up with the Landler. He grew up with tavern musicians. His father owned a tavern, so he heard a lot of this stuff, you know, growing up as a child. And then, of course, he knocked around a lot of smaller towns as he sort of climbed the ladder conducting-wise until he finally wound up in Vienna, where, you know, he's at the pinnacle of society and that, you know, end of the Habsburg Empire, wonderfully decadent, but also kind of, what's the word? It's not cursed, but it was, you know, the end was looming. The storm clouds were on the horizon. You know, World War I had not happened yet, of course, but that energy was in the air, you know what I mean? But the Viennese were still trying to live in the past in some ways, but also looking forward because, you know, Mahler knew people like Freud, for example. He actually went for therapy. He sat on Freud's couch, believe it or not. So, you know, and you had, you know, artists like Klimt and Kokoschka and Walter Gropius and all these people, their lives intersected in this time in Vienna, and it's always fascinated me. That's one of the most fascinating periods in time in all history for me, really, in Europe, that fin de siècle, you know, turn of the 20th century. And Mahler is very much a product of that. So, you know, when you say there's no folk music, yes and no. I mean, it's there, but the connection, maybe you just have to dig a little bit deeper to find it in some sense. It's not as overt as it is in some of the other symphonies. This is true.
This is a symphony that, unlike other symphonies, where he left pretty specific rules about what it was about and what had to be accomplished. This one, not so much. There was no sort of biographical or thematic thesis that he attached to this thing.
Well, he wanted to depart from, you know, programmatic music, using air quotes, from the Fifth Symphony, the Sixth Symphony to it. You know, Sixth is called the Tragic, but he didn't really give it that title. The Seventh also, you know, is a little bit, the Seventh is kind of like the ugly duckling of them for many people, but I think the Seventh is wonderful. It's just hard to wrap your mind around it. And then he returned, of course, to a more specific storyline for the Eighth Symphony, the Symphony of a Thousand. The second part of it, you know, based on Faust, is the closest thing that Mahler ever wrote to an opera, actually. And then when we get to the Ninth Symphony, again, it's a little bit more abstract. But Mahler actually did, I think, have some very specific things in mind when he was composing the Fifth. And in fact, he had some working titles for some of the movements, which he then struck out when the piece was published, because he wanted it to be absolute music. And that was something that he was really keen to develop, just music for music's sake, so it didn't have to necessarily be about one specific thing. It could mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people, which is, I think, one of the most intriguing parts about the Fifth Symphony, because they're obvious. I mean, the funeral march is obviously a funeral march. But what does it mean? What does it mean to you? What does it mean to me? What did it mean to Mahler is probably the most important thing for us as musicians to think about. And for that, you know, the I've enjoyed preparing for this symphony. It's my first time conducting the Fifth of Mahler. And, you know, I've done so much extra research, even more than I normally do, to try to sort of get inside his head. And the famous fanfare, you know, that the first trumpet plays, for example, to open. I found a couple references to this, and then actually saw it online right there in front of me, that it's actually an authentic Austrian military signal from the 19th century, like mid 18th into 19th century, which Haydn used also. Haydn used it in his military symphony, the 100th symphony, at the end of one of the movements. The second trumpet actually plays it. But it's you know, da-da-ga-dun, da-da-ga-dun. You hear it very, it's in thirds, and Mahler, of course, expands it at the end, but at the beginning, it's a direct quote, except it's, you know, in C sharp, which probably it wouldn't be in the actual original context. So what does it mean? Well, it's the Generalmarsch, which means assemble the troops, everyone get together, you know, line up. And that means, you know, maybe we're going to battle, maybe there's a ceremony, maybe there's a funeral, we don't know what's going to happen, but there's a great sense of anticipation, and it's a call to order, basically. So Mahler gives us that out of the gate, and it's sort of, you know, I think, let me just give you an image for the opening, because Mahler, as I said, as a child, grew up in this military town. He was right by the square where they did their military exercises, so he would have witnessed not only the military bands, but the troops, you know, doing their formations, doing their exercises, and the bands that accompanied those occasions. He also witnessed military funerals. He also had many of his siblings die in childhood. So he was surrounded by death, and this connection with the military also is very important. So an image that I like to think of for the opening of the Fifth Symphony is you hear the call of the trumpet, and Mahler, maybe as a child, you know, he's an adult now, but he's remembering being a child and being just down the street from that square and hearing that signal, thinking, oh, something's about to happen. What's about to happen? And Mahler tells us in the score that it's supposed to be like a funeral cortege, like a procession, a funeral procession specifically. So imagine Mahler as an adult, having just, by the way, gone through his own near-death experience where he almost died of a hemorrhage where he lost a third of his blood a few years before. He wrote the Fifth Symphony. Imagine him as an adult thinking back to his childhood, hearing that signal, maybe going down the street or looking in that direction to see what's coming, and then all of a sudden, bang, it hits him like a ton of bricks. It's a funeral. Someone has died. And all the emotions that would conjure up for the adult Mahler thinking back to his childhood, which was surrounded by death, and then relating it back to his own experience as an adult where he himself almost died. And the whole thing just takes on this much more, it's just much more depth when you think about it that way.
Would the people of Mahler's era have known that trumpet call? Because we, in the 21st century, wouldn't know that trumpet call, but would they have known that that was a gathering call for the military?
I don't think all of them would, but I think some of them certainly would. Maybe an older generation or people with a military background probably would have gotten the reference. Yeah.
So we start with this trumpet call, with this funeral, and where do we go from there, Ward?
Well, it's an extraordinary journey. Let's back up for just a second. The evolution of the piece, actually, the Fifth Symphony, is worth mentioning because he actually wrote the third movement first, the scherzo. That came first. And it's the biggest scherzo he's ever written, and it's one of the longest, probably most complicated scherzos in all the symphonic repertoire, in fact. It's nearly 20 minutes long, and it's the third movement, so it comes in the middle of this journey, which starts with this very, very painful grief, you know, in the funeral march. And actually, at the end of the symphony, we manage to arrive at a point of pure joy and happiness and humor and, you know, just wonderful lightness after the heavy atmosphere in the beginning. And the third movement, the scherzo, is kind of like the fulcrum point for that journey, because Mahler actually divided the symphony into three parts. So there are five movements, but he says it's in three parts. So the first part, I know. And if you think about it, remember, Mahler was a great conductor. He was probably the best conductor on the planet in his lifetime, and he was the head of the Vienna Opera, which was the pinnacle of the art form. So he was conducting opera constantly. All this opera music was coursing through him throughout the season, and he would write his symphonies in the off season. And so when I see that he puts it in three parts, I can't help but thinking about an opera in three acts, of an opera in three acts, right? So the first act is the tragic side, the sad side. The first movement is about, as I said, grief. The second movement, which I'll go back to in a minute, is more about depression and violent mood swings. And, you know, it's the struggle to be happy. Mahler actually said that himself at one point when he was rehearsing it and it was recorded. Then the third movement is amazing because it combines the joy that we will feel at the end of the symphony with a little bit of the shadows of the tragedy that came before, but on the whole, it's a very happy, optimistic movement. And he began here because, as I said, he had just had a near-death experience. He was recovering in the countryside, you know, and just trying to relax, and he was grateful for his restored health. And so he began sketching for this scherzo, and it comes actually from a concept he had for the Fourth Symphony, believe it or not. He was originally going to put a scherzo in the Fourth Symphony, and he was going to title it The World Without Gravity, which is a great thing to think about just because the weight has been lifted off of his shoulders because all of a sudden, you know, he's in better health, having almost died not too long before. But then, you know, when he decided to not include it in the Fourth Symphony, he really completed it for the Fifth. And the horn plays the central role throughout the movement. The horn is kind of I think of the horn as a combination between the all-powerful life force, you know, which Mahler's grateful for, and also this kind of mystical shepherd who's guiding Mahler or anyone, the protagonist, through this complicated landscape, which is called life. And it's also interesting because I think it was Bruno Walter, who was a very close to Mahler. He was his student, his assistant, and he worked under him quite a bit, both, I think, in Hamburg and in Vienna. And he says that there's a definite link with Goethe and also with Schubert, because Schubert wrote a song cycle on called Time the Great Coachman, which was based on a Goethe poem. And there are moments in the poem where, you know, he says, you know, blow your bugle. And if you think about how the horns introduce the solo line with all the repeated Fs and it's sort of like this rousing call, you can't help but think that he got inspired by that line in the Goethe poem. And then it talks about the passage of time and how you have to go through it and how there's ups and downs. And, you know, it's once you read the poem and you discover this, the connection becomes pretty clear with the third movement of the Fifth Symphony.
And scherzo gave them a lot of grief in the very first rehearsal. And, and Mahler actually sent a letter to Alma saying, "The scherzo is the very devil of a movement. I see it is in for a peck of troubles. Conductors for the next 50 years will all take it too fast and make nonsense of it."
That's right.
So this is a warning to you.
Well, he writes not so fast, nicht so schnell, in the beginning. And one thing I think about a lot when I conduct the Mahler symphonies is obviously his own ability as a conductor, because as I said before, he really knew what he was talking about. And so you have to trust him. When he writes something in the score, he really means it. And, you know, it's amazing. There are moments where, you know, this week we've been rehearsing and I feel there's a building of a phrase or a line is going and it's all going very well. And I'll think, oh, this is, you know, maybe I could push it a little bit here. Maybe we could let this phrase grow. And then I look down and right at that moment where I felt it instinctively, he says, "Nicht eilen," meaning don't rush, like not yet. Don't do it. It's like he's inside your head. It's amazing. Or, you know, he'll give you other little bits of advice and where they fall in the score from the conductor's perspective, it's really eerie sometimes. You feel like Mahler's really over your shoulder. And you have to respect everything he said in the score. You have to do it. And it actually works if you do it the way he intended it.
Well, you may be over your shoulders. You don't know. You know, if you feel kind of a cold breeze on your neck, Mr. Mahler may be in the house.
Right.
All right. So in between this scherzo, Nicht so schnell, and the call to arms, which begins everything, there is a middle movement. There's a movement in between that. And it's one that's kind of angry.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about it.
Well, it's, you know, he says in the beginning, I think he says, you know, very vehement and, you know, basically really intense. And it's, Mahler was known to be someone who was kind of mercurial. I mean, he was a workaholic. He was very intense at all times. But, you know, people, there are many accounts of, you know, him being at a dinner party or in a room, and all of a sudden he would just get up and leave because he was dissatisfied with something. Or you'd be talking to him and he'd be smiling, and then all of a sudden, with no warning, his, you know, his visage, everything would just change, and he would all of a sudden be so dour and dark. Like, he could just turn on a dime in this way. And I think, you know, that's kind of a hallmark of someone who's dealing or has dealt with depression. I mean, the big swings of emotion. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think Mahler wanted to be happy. And he said during a rehearsal, I think in Amsterdam, to the orchestra, he said, this struggle in this second movement is the struggle to try to be happy. You know, I'm trying to be happy, but I just can't. I can't do it. And it's amazing when you listen to the music, because there are all these really labored climaxes that we build up to, and it's like you can feel that visceral struggle, and then just when you get over the hump and you think you're gonna succeed and you're gonna be happy, then these climaxes that we reach, they all dissolve, they disappear, and it almost seems like in total chaos. You know, the orchestra literally spirals down to almost nothing, and you're left with just a roll in the timpani or something, and it's like, whoa, okay. He tried, he failed, and now he's sad again. And so it's that really, really bumpy landscape of the second movement, which I think you really have to be mindful of. And even at the very end, Mahler says in his score, he points with two arrows and writes, climax. This is the climax of the movement, just in case you're wondering, because there are so many ups and downs in it. And, you know, it's good that he put it in there. But even that climax at the end dissolves to a degree. It doesn't completely dissolve, so you're left with an eerie sense of light optimism. You know, like, maybe it's going to be okay this time, but I'm still not sure.
And maybe it's just a cruel joke.
Right. There's the big question mark at the end. And actually, in the score, Mahler suggests a long pause between the second and third movement, which is interesting because the scherzo, which we were just talking about, opens with a complete change in character. I mean, it's all joy. I think of it as laughter. The horns play this one. And it's a dance. It's Landler. It's a country party. It's just beautiful. There's little references to yodeling, you know. It's very folksy. This is the folksiest part of the symphony, is the scherzo, for sure. And then once we go through the scherzo, after we have the Landler, then we eventually arrive in Vienna, which is great because it's the combination between, you know, the folk, the countryside, and the big city. It's the combination of innocence, which is the Landler, the country life, and experience, which is the big city, Vienna. And all those juxtapositions were very much a part of Mahler's own experience.
He was, in fact, considered to be a bit of a country bumpkin.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like you can take the boy out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the boy. And I think about that a lot in the scherzo, because there are moments where we have the Viennese waltz, which is noticeably more refined than the Landler, and it's supposed to be like that. And then the mood of Vienna, the hectic atmosphere, the hustle and bustle, you hear that coming over the orchestra, and it gets more and more and more hectic. And, you know, Mahler didn't, it wasn't a joyride for him in Vienna by any means. He had a lot of battles that he had to fight, and he didn't win them all, and he was up against quite a bit. So you build up to this sort of froth in the Viennese sections, and then all of a sudden it just goes away, and we get back to the ha-ha-ha, and I think it's Mahler just taking a step back and laughing and saying, it's okay, I'm still happy. I got the best gig in the world. I'm the head of the Vienna Opera. What am I so worried about? You know, it's great.
And then, there is the Adagietto, which is so often played just on its own.
Mm-hmm.
So beautiful, so evocative, extraordinary. Is it really a love letter?
Well, I think the best way to describe it, trying to avoid being over-sentimental or, you know, sensationalizing the context of it, is to say that it's a song without words. I don't think there's a famous story that Mengelberg told. Mengelberg, of course, was the conductor in Amsterdam who was, again, a big follower of Mahler, and he started the first Mahler Festival after Mahler passed away, and he was very keen to perform Mahler's works, so much so that he would himself, and he was a great conductor by many accounts, he would prepare his orchestra in Amsterdam for over a week on the symphonies before Mahler arrived so that they were in good shape by the time Mahler got there. And then he would sit out like a student in the hall while Mahler conducted his orchestra and take notes in the, you know, column in the sides of the score and the pages of his own personal score. And we have that. That survived, which is great. But then he also said that both Alma and Gustav had told him on separate occasions that while they were courting, before they were married, Gustav wanted to write Alma a letter, and, you know, but he couldn't find the words, so he wrote her a piece of music instead. And of course, because Alma was herself a very accomplished musician, she would get it. So he sent her the Adagietto, and she read it, maybe even played it at the piano, who knows, and immediately knew what he meant and sent back a message to him and said, tell him to come here at once. And, you know, and then the rest, it's kind of an overblown romantic story. And it's interesting also because I read actually from more than one source, authors who and scholars who make the very good point that if this was really true, it's hard to believe that Alma never put that in any of her recollections or her memoirs, because she really capitalized on being Mahler's widow. And we never have that in writing from Alma. And also, before Alma and Gustav were married, there was this woman named Natalie, who was a violist, who was hoping to be Mahler's wife, and she sort of followed him around constantly. And we have a lot of great insight from about his creative process from Natalie, because she would be with Mahler and his sister and, you know, his sort of group, his entourage in the summertime when Mahler was still single, and they would all hang out and Mahler would compose, and she would sort of follow him around on his walks and pick his brain and write everything down every night in her diary. And she was with Mahler, you know, basically up until he met Alma and started courting her, because, like I said, she wanted to be Mrs. Mahler. And she never says anything about the context of that letter, and she probably would have too. So I think it might have been Mengelberg's invention.
Or Alma's invention that she...
She told Mengelberg, but then she backed away from it because she herself never wrote about it. So I don't know. I mean, you know, Mahler wrote her Liebstum Schönheit, and she had a framed manuscript of it on her wall in New York till the day she died. So, I mean, it's hard to believe that when she was so proud of all these little trophies and stories that she never really made a big deal out of that. But we also know that the Adagietto is very similar to some of the Rückertlieder, you know, Ich bin der Welt abhanden gekommen, which is one of his most beautiful songs, is very similar in mood and texture, even in some of the phrases and the melodies to the Adagietto. So it leads many to think, and I tend to agree, that it's probably a song without words, because a lot of times Mahler found the melody before he found the text. He would have it sort of floating around in his mind, and then all of a sudden one day, bang, he'd see the text and think, oop, that goes with that idea that I've had floating around in my head. So I have a feeling that the Adagietto was sort of marinating in his mind for a while, and maybe Alma, maybe meeting her, she was the muse, you know, she was the inspiration, she was the story, she was the song without words, but, you know, that was what inspired Mahler to actually get the Adagietto out. But I do think it's very, very much a song.
And then finishing off, big, as Mahler does, but there's something about the finish of the fifth that doesn't have that same big blast feeling. There's something, help me out here.
Well, it's light. It's funny. I mean, remember the journey. So we go from this, you know, absolute despair and the deepest grief you can imagine in the opening. And by the end, we're literally laughing so hard we're probably falling out of our chair. I mean, it's about humor. It's about joy. He's poking fun also at himself, and he's also, sticking his tongue out at the critics, which I love. The opening of the fifth movement, he quotes another song of his from Wunderhorn, which the title translated is in praise of high intellect, or in high praise of great intellect. And it's a joke. The song in the Wunderhorn is that tells the story of a nightingale and a cuckoo in the forest who are want to have a singing competition, and they need to select a judge to be the judge. And the cuckoo says, "I'll pick the judge." And so there's a donkey there, and they think, well, obviously the donkey would make a great judge because he has such big ears. He must be able to hear so well. And so the donkey says, "Yes, of course, I will be the judge." And the donkey listens to the cuckoo sing and says, "Oh, that was marvelous, marvelous." And the cuckoo, of course, we all know, it's a very simple song that a cuckoo sings. Then the nightingale sings, and it's much more complicated, it's more florid, it's more lyrical, it's more beautiful, and it's completely baffling to the donkey, who's kind of simple-minded. He doesn't get the nightingale's song. So at the end, he looks at them both and proclaims that the nightingale's way too complicated, doesn't understand it, cuckoo, beautiful, cuckoo, you're the winner. And so it's a joke about critics and how they don't always understand everything that they should, and Mahler certainly experienced a lot of that. And actually, his original title for it was In Lob der Kritik, which means in praise of critics. And then he changed his mind and decided to make it a little bit more veiled, but it's definitely a stab at critics, and it's a joke. And he said himself, Mahler, that people were not going to understand this symphony. So at the end, he got to a very happy place, and he's poking fun at himself and actually poking fun at the critics, saying, "You know what? You're not going to get it. You're going to rip me apart for this, but I don't care."
In fact, Louis Elson from the Boston Daily Advertiser in 1914 wrote a long poem called A Modern Symphony that was dissing the Fifth. He hated it. And a year before that, in the New York Sun, they wrote, "Mahler had not much to say in his Fifth Symphony and occupied a wondrous time in saying it. His manner is ponderous, his matter imponderable."
Yep. That's, people, he always said, "My time will come, Mahler." People just didn't get him.
So let me ask you, why Mahler? I mean, this seems to be, in the world of maestros, the thing that, there's always the Beethoven cycle. But why the Mahler cycle? What is it about Mahler that speaks to y'all, to all y'all, that you want to do these cycles?
Well, as I said before, I think there's a very, for any conductor actually going through the piece, you feel very close to Mahler, because you're looking at, it's like I said, he's basically giving you advice along the way, and you have to, once you think of it from his perspective and realize what an accomplished conductor he was, it's sort of, you feel like, he was one of us. But that's much less important than the bigger picture, which is that Mahler, he said famously that, a symphony should include everything, the whole world, it's got everything. And there's so much complexity in all of his works, really, but especially the symphonies. Some of the songs are just, simple songs, but even the songs are more complicated. But it's a combination, I think, of the way he uses the orchestra, the way he, writes for it, the way he develops all of his symphonies, really, from beginning to end. Each one, there's a very careful path, and you have to navigate it, and there's not one right answer either. There's, it's amazing in the contradictions, for the interpreter, because you can do everything Mahler says and still have room for your own interpretation. You're not handcuffed by what Mahler wrote. At the same time, you have to be very mindful and very respectful of what he wrote, because if you depart from it in a major way, then the whole structure falls apart. And so it's kind of like a fascinating puzzle, I think, for most conductors, and it's a great opportunity for a conductor to increase the depth of his or her relationship with the orchestra, because there's so much that an orchestra has to do in the course of a Mahler symphony, much more so than any Brahms symphony, Beethoven symphony, I was thinking about this a lot, even the Shostakovich symphonies, you know, think about the great symphonists going back to Haydn, okay? Haydn, I think, the first great symphonist. I'm a huge Haydn fan, love Haydn. And actually, I digress for a moment, but there's references to Haydn in the fifth movement of the Fifth Symphony, Mahler's, because he was a Haydn fan as well. In fact, he resurrected one of Haydn's forgotten operas while he was in Vienna, which everyone thought, what are you doing? I mean, it was amazing. So Mahler, when you hear all the eighth notes and the contrapuntal passages in the fifth movement, that's a direct relationship to Haydn and, you know, all sorts of different species of counterpoint. It's very funny. So Haydn, great symphonist. Beethoven, of course, great symphonist.
You skipped over Mozart.
Well, I don't think Mozart was a great symphonist. I think he was a great opera. I mean, his opera is unparalleled. Mozart opera is like the pinnacle. It's unbelievable. But his symphonies, I don't think they're extraordinary. They're not, I mean, I'm not saying they're bad. Don't get me wrong. But he didn't, I don't think, when I think of Mozart, if I had, you know, my desert island, my, you know, greatest hits, I could only pick a few things, it would definitely be Mozart's operas, not his symphonies. But Haydn, I mean, I always prefer a Haydn symphony to a Mozart symphony. It's just me. So Haydn, Beethoven, obviously did a ton for the symphony. Brahms did a lot for the symphony. In a strange way, Berlioz is there on the side, in the column, in a way.
If nothing else, he gave us trombones.
Right. Well, you know, so Beethoven gave us trombones. There are trombones in Beethoven. But then you move through. So after that, the next great symphonist was really Mahler. And then after that, I think Shostakovich was probably the last really great symphonist. But I started to say this when I got sidetracked by that. Shostakovich symphonies tend to be a little bit more concentrated in their general themes, you know, like we just did the fifth recently, and it's about the oppression and, you know, there are a lot of complexities that go into that, you know, trying to survive in the face of this oppression, but it's more, the mood from beginning to end is more closely related than Mahler, where you have this just tremendous range from the depths of despair to the high intoxication of, you know, frivolity and joy and love and humor. You rarely get such a wide span in any work, and I think and all of Mahler's symphonies just have incredible depth, so they're endlessly rewarding for both the orchestra and especially for the conductor.
Yeah, this one of the fifth really begins with a funeral and ends with laughter.
It does. I mean, hey, what a great way to spend an evening, right? You know, go on a little journey and end up very happy. In fact, you know, talking about the critics, there's a great story that at the end of the symphony, you know, it gets really rambunctious at the end, and it sort of gets faster and faster. And a lot of the themes come back, and, you know, he's making fun of the critics in the beginning, and then at the very end, you know, it's almost like running downhill and then you trip and fall and just sort of do a somersault to the bottom. Almost feels that way sometimes when the snowballs at the end, but it's great. It's meant to be that way. And so, it was said once that there was a critic who was at the top of the stairs, and Mahler just kicked him down the stairs, and he tumbled down the stairs out the door, and the door slammed, boom, behind him, and that was it. Goodbye. You know, just kind of, again, a moment of slapstick, physical comedy, you know, at the end of the symphony, which began in the depths of despair. It's amazing. I mean, it's just to get there from where we began. It's I love it.
We look forward to taking this journey with you over the this week with your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. Thank you so much for being here, Ward.
Always a pleasure.
Ward Stair is the music director of your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. And if you'd like more information about the RPO season, you can go to rpo.org. I'm Julia Figueres. This podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.